Easter. We're continuing this sermon series, paying attention to the life and the teachings of Jesus leading up to his death and his resurrection in John's Gospel. Last week, we looked at the way to the Father in John 14. Next week, we'll look at the way of the Spirit in John 16. Today's sermon, maybe we can call it the way of the vine in John 15. There's a rock band that I like listening to called Switchfoot. One of their songs features this line. It says, "Life is short. I want to live it well." I think there's something in that, whether you like Switchfoot or not, whether that's your style of music or not, whether that's your generation or not, there's something in that line that I think connects with each of our hearts. There are some retirement age or grandparent age folks here who may feel more keenly than the teenagers that life is short. And I suppose that those who are in the retirement years or the grandparent years would be quick to recommend to the rest of us the importance of living life well. There are some here in very young years of life. And when I was young, I suppose I'm not anymore, but back when I was young, I remember people would talk to me about the importance of understanding that life is short, and it made no sense to me whatsoever, and I disregarded it. And maybe you've heard me say this before, but if you're a teenager or a 20-something here, and you hear me saying life is short, and you're like, whatever, I don't believe you, all I can say is that's what I thought when I was your age too, but I think you'll figure it out someday. And so teenagers, 20-somethings, life is kind of short. And I hope there's a longing inside you, even in your teenage years, even in your 20s, not just to mindlessly float through life, but to live the life that God has given you well. And for those of us who may feel at times lost in the middle of this short life that we live, I think if your heart is something like mine, you feel the importance of living life well. See, here's an important question from a rock and roll band called Switchfoot. An important question for all of us. The question goes something like this: if life is short, how do we live it well? It's an important question for us to consider. And of course, there are lots of answers to that question in the world that we live in. And maybe we could show that there are a variety of ways that the Bible itself answers that kind of question. But today we want to slow down and listen to the words of Jesus on the night when he was betrayed. And we want to listen to what Jesus teaches about how we can live well. Just to give you a sense of where we're going as we follow these words that were read from John 15, verses 1 through 17, just to give you kind of a roadmap here. We'll follow the teaching of Jesus in this passage as Jesus gives us, first of all, a profound picture of life lived well, and then two vital lessons for life lived well. First, a profound picture of life, and then two vital lessons for life. We'll begin with the profound picture that Jesus paints, a picture of God's people as God's vineyard. Look with me again, if you would, at John 15, verse 1. It says, "I am the true vine." Jesus is saying not so much that, like, I'm not the false vine, but like the authentic thing, the real deal. "I am the authentic vine," Jesus says. And my father is like a vine dresser or a gardener, we might say in another translation. And then maybe you can let your eyes drift down to John 15:5, where Jesus continues to fill out this picture that he's painting to create an analogy for us. He says in verse 5, I am the vine, you are the branches. There's this picture here that Jesus is painting of God's people being like God's vineyard, the places where grapes are grown. And I don't know what comes to your mind when you think of a vineyard. Maybe some of us get a picture in our mind of Napa Valley. Maybe under the blue horizon, you can picture rolling hills with rows of vibrant green grapevines flourishing under the summer sun. Maybe you picture the sunset as the sun grows closer to the hills ahead and the golden light scrapes its way across those green grapevines. Maybe you picture yourself sitting there eating delicious food, raising a glass, sharing delicious food and something good to drink with your beloved family members. And in that moment, surrounded by the beauty of the vineyard itself, tasting delicious things from God's good creation, and multiplying those joys by sharing them with loved ones in your life. As you picture that, you might think of this as something like an image of a good life. In fact, in Jesus' day, this was very much like one of the primary images of what a life lived well would look like. Whether you're talking to Roman people in Jesus' day, Greek people, or Jewish people in Jesus' day, this is a picture of what a good life would look like, a life in the vineyard. And in fact, this picture of a good life in God's vineyard, and more specifically, this analogy of God's people being like God's vineyard, is a word picture that goes back much further in history than Jesus himself. This picture of God's people being like God's vineyard comes from the ancient Hebrew prophets. It's actually a picture used multiple times. Maybe the clearest example of it comes from Isaiah chapter 5. When the ancient Hebrew prophet, generations before Jesus, described God's people as being like God's vineyard. Isaiah 5:1 says, I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. Verse 2, he dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. You hear this imagery of all of these pictures of what goes into a life full of abundant joy. And then Isaiah 5:2 describes the Lord coming to inspect his vineyard. Isaiah 5:2 says, then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but here's the problem as Isaiah, the ancient Hebrew prophet, describes it. It yielded only bad fruit. And so Isaiah 5 continues to warn of judgment that's coming. Now I will tell you what I am going to do with my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. And then Isaiah 5:7 kind of summarizes this section of Isaiah's prophetic message about God's people being like God's vineyard. It says, "The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw instead bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but heard instead cries of distress." You see, when Isaiah and other ancient Hebrew prophets before Jesus had used this picture of God's people being like God's vineyard, very often it was an uncomfortable message that the Hebrew prophets were conveying. Why was it an uncomfortable message? Because they were warning people that an inspection of our lives is coming. And they were saying to the people of God, "Be careful, be careful. Be careful, because God's inspection day is coming." That's how the ancient Hebrew prophets had used this picture of God's people being like God's vineyard. It was a message with what we might call an uncomfortable warning in it. I wonder, is there an uncomfortable warning in Jesus' use of this picture of God's people being like God's vineyard? Look with me again, if you would, at verse 2. Jesus says, "Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, the Father, the great gardener in his vineyard, he takes it away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit." Do you hear kind of the uncomfortable message that Jesus is suggesting here in this picture? Maybe it's a surprise to us to move from this beautiful, idyllic scene of rolling green hills under the blue sky, tasting the good fruit of God's creation. Maybe it's a surprise to us to move from that beautiful, idyllic picture to this warning. This warning that we also need to be careful, because God's inspection of our lives is coming. Jesus was speaking these words originally on the night when he was betrayed. And as we've noticed in the last few weeks, shortly before Jesus said these words, Judas had stood up and left the other disciples to walk out into the darkness in betrayal of Jesus. And shortly before Jesus spoke these words, Peter had insisted, "Lord, I'll follow you no matter the cost." But Jesus had replied by saying, "No, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And so here in the immediate backdrop of Jesus saying these things, we have a picture of one whose life was closely connected to Jesus, one whose life was around Jesus for a number of years, one whose life was intertwined with other disciples' lives in all kinds of ways, yet one whose life proved to be only superficially connected with Jesus. So that ultimately, listen, the Lord is slow to anger. He's patient. But eventually Jesus warns, for those who are only superficially connected with Jesus, who will never bear fruit in God's vineyard, those who, like Judas, may have their lives intertwined with other disciples, yet who are not really connected with Jesus, there is a day coming when the Lord will remove. And if you say, "No, well, that's not me, I'm connected with Jesus and there's fruit in my life," There's an uncomfortable word for us as well, because Jesus says that every branch that bears fruit, God like a skilled vine dresser, God like a skilled gardener who knows how to take care of grape vines, will prune them every winter, cutting things off, cutting things out. Just like in Peter's life, no matter how pious it seemed, when he said, "Lord, I'll follow you no matter what the cost is," there was a self-confidence in that that the Lord needed to cut out of his life. Do you see what I mean? No matter how pious it seemed, no matter how courageous it seemed, when Peter said, "Lord, I'd follow you even if it meant dying with you," there's kind of a self-exaltation that the Lord would need to cut out of his life. There would be pruning needed even for the most fruitful of all disciples. There is pruning needed even in your life and in mine, no matter how fruitfully connected we may feel we are with Jesus. But listen, there's a warning here. There's a warning here. There's a sharp edge, if you will, to this picture that Jesus gives us of God's people being like God's vineyard. There's a warning that says the Lord is coming to inspect our lives, and the Lord is looking for a harvest of good fruit. There's a little bit of a warning in that. But there is also, listen, there is also profoundly good news here in John 15 as Jesus uses this picture. Because as Jesus takes up this picture that the Hebrew prophets had used so many times to warn God's people that God is coming for a day of inspection, listen, there's good news here, because as Jesus picks up this word picture, he doesn't just say to us, "A day of inspection is coming, so try harder." That would not be good news. Why? Because no matter how hard we try, where are we going to end up? Jesus does not say a day of inspection is coming, so just work your emotions up into better joy yourself. Be a happier disciple. Jesus doesn't say to us, "A day of inspection is coming, so make sure your life looks successful and impressive." It's not what Jesus says, is it? As Jesus picks up this imagery of God's people like God's vineyard, Jesus doesn't just say there's a day of inspection coming, so try harder. He says a day of inspection is coming, and good news, I am the genuine vine. Everything you need for life and fruitfulness, Jesus is saying, is found in me. Not me, Jesus, you know what I mean. Jesus is calling us to discover everything we need to live life well and to live life fruitfully as God's people. He's inviting us to find it, not just by trying harder, not just by finding more answers, not just by working up our emotions, not just by looking successful by worldly standards. No, he invites us to live well. How? By getting connected with the true vine, Jesus Christ himself. So that's the profound picture that Jesus gives us. It's a picture of life in God's vineyard. And at the core of this picture of life in God's vineyard is both a warning, be careful, a day of judgment is coming, be careful, a day of inspection of our lives is coming, and a promise, good news, Jesus is the vine who provides all that you need. Well, what will we do with this? What lessons do we actually learn for our lives? I think I can boil it down, as best as I can tell, I think I can boil it down to two really important lessons for us. Now, let me pause before I get into them and say, there are 17 verses of precious words of Jesus here, and every one of them is worth thinking about. But in order to get out of here before lunch, I got to do some summarizing. So if some of you are like, but I really like verse 7 and you didn't say a lot about it, good, I love verse 7 too. You can talk with your friends about it over lunch. I'm kind of joking with you, but you get what I mean. We're going to have to do some summarizing here as we're listening to these profound words of Jesus. And if we do some summarizing, I think we can put the teaching of Jesus, the lessons that we need to take away, into two main lessons here. Lesson number one, abide in His love. Abide in His love. In fact, look with me if you would at verse 9. Jesus says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. You didn't gasp, so I don't think you got that. Okay, I've used this joke before, but you know, like when they come out with the next translation of the Bible, I think they need to insert emojis at some points. And I think we need the exploding head emoji right there in this verse. As the Father has loved me, Jesus says to you. Are you connected with Jesus? This is how Jesus views you. As much as God the Father loves Jesus. And this is, why is this mind explode? Because like some of us are like, I think Jesus is kind of tolerating me and kind of okay with me being at the fringes of the family. But do you know how Jesus describes His love for us? He describes it like this. As much as the Father loves Jesus. Do you believe that's a lot? As much as the Father loves Jesus. This isn't my opinion. This is what, I'm just telling you what Jesus says. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you, Jesus says. Exploding head emoji. And then Jesus backs it up with this simple word of direction. You want to know how to live in light of that? He says, abide in my love. Now, what does this word abiding mean? It's not the most common word for us in the English language or in our daily lives. Maybe some of us younger folks, maybe some of the younger folks here will know a meme that features a photograph of Sam Elliott, the actor, wearing a cowboy hat in a bowling alley with the words, "The dude abides." Underneath, I think that's supposed to signify that the dude keeps on going. The dude remains. The dude stays alive, something along those lines. Or maybe when we think of the word abiding, we just make an association with the word abode, like the place you live. Now, so far, these word associations prove absolutely nothing. But I want to suggest to you that we're not wildly off base if we think of abiding having something to do with remaining or staying on course, and if we think it has something to do with the place that we live and find our lives. An analogy in the New Testament, because it's kind of weird, I just want to admit, when Jesus says, abide in me, it's kind of a hard idea for us to figure it. Like, what does Jesus really mean when he says, abide in me? It's kind of hard for us to figure it out. Here's a Bible parallel to this. Some of you may know in the Christmas story, when Mary is pregnant, Mary goes to stay with her cousin Elizabeth for 3 months during her pregnancy. And according to Luke 1:56, I think that's the right verse. I might have got that wrong at the time. According to Luke 1:56, the word that's used there is the same word we get here in John 15 when it says that Mary was abiding with Elizabeth for 3 months. So what does that mean if Mary is abiding with Elizabeth for 3 months? At least for Mary, abiding with Elizabeth probably meant something like this. It probably meant finding shelter and safety in Elizabeth's home. It probably meant receiving provision for what she needed today and this week. It probably included a warm and caring relationship, like the best kinds of loving relationships we can experience in the best kinds of family relationships that we've ever... It probably included something like that. It probably included, to some degree at least, Mary learning practical, real-life lessons from her older cousin Elizabeth on a day-to-day basis. But above all, and more than anything else, what did it mean that Mary abided with Elizabeth? More than anything else, more practically than anything else, it just meant that Mary was staying with Elizabeth rather than leaving. And I want to suggest for us that when we turn to John 15 and we hear Jesus saying to us, abide in me, and when we hear Jesus saying to us in John 15, 9, abide in my love, it's got some of those similar flavors to it. What does it mean to abide in his love for us? It means finding shelter and safety with Jesus. It means receiving the provision of what you're going to need this week from Jesus. It has at least suggestions of experiencing a kind of family relationship with Jesus. Receiving his care, his affection, his God the Father for God the Son-sized love for you in a family kind of relationship. On a day-to-day basis, it probably involves learning some practical lessons for life from Jesus. But more than anything else, do you know what it means for us kind of at a practical level to abide in his love for us? It just means staying there in his love rather than leaving. Now, I'm not saying that's all there is to this idea. Christians for thousands of years have found these some of the most fruitful verses to think about and to pray over day after day after day. Considering this idea of Jesus like the root from which all of our holiness, the root from which all of our righteousness, the root from which all of our our pursuits of justice, the roots from which all of our wise living, it all comes from the roots of Jesus Christ. And there is something profound about thinking about the fact that a branch of a grapevine doesn't draw up nutrients from the soil itself. No, a branch on a grapevine simply receives the nutrients that the vine is pushing into it day after day. If you don't believe me, this is how we get maple syrup. Cut off a branch, and what happens? The sap keeps pushing out. Do you see what I mean? There's something profound about thinking about our deep personal union. That's the word that we use sometimes theologically. Our union with Jesus Christ, such that as a branch is really united with the vine that it grows out of, and as that branch receives day by day everything it needs so that it can branch out and bear good fruit, so that it can branch out and produce delicious fruit to the Father's glory, just as a vine and a branch work like that, Jesus says to you and to me, the way that the Father loves me, that's how I love you. And if you want to live your life well, if you want to live your life fruitfully, if you want to flourish in God's design for your life, here's something that you're going to need to learn, Jesus says. Just stay in my love. Just find your safety and shelter there. Just keep on finding the provision you need this week in knowing how much He loves you. Just keep on enjoying the access that we have as we hear His words and we meditate on them, and then we turn them into our prayers and we take our prayers to God and live in communion with God. As you keep living your life like that, in that kind of relation, as you keep learning from Jesus and obeying and following the directions that He's giving you, the concrete, practical, clear words that He says, go this way instead of that way, as we keep on learning direction from Jesus and following that, as we just keep on staying with Him and finding our life in Him rather than leaving and looking for life elsewhere, Jesus says, that's where true life is found. Jesus says, I am the true vine. You are loved and vitally connected with me, dear disciples, Jesus says. I'm the true vine. And to his disciples, he says, you are loved and vitally connected to me, so that as you dwell in the realm of my love, as you continue to experience it day by day, that's how you can live the kind of life that will produce a lot of good fruit. And keep on producing a lot of good fruit to the glory of God's name. Here's the first lesson that we need to learn from this passage. It's a lesson about abiding in His love for us. The second lesson that we need to learn here, if we're paying attention to Jesus' words and how He moves in this, and how His words move us forward in this passage, the second lesson is this. Jesus teaches us not only to abide in His love, but also to abound in love for others. You can see it in verses 12 and 17. This is my commandment, Jesus says, that you love one another as I have loved you. And then verse 17. These things I command you so that you will, what? Love one another. As Jesus boils down his vision for our lives, as Jesus boils down his direction for flourishing in your faith, Jesus says, I can kind of summarize it in one direction, love each other. Now, does that mean that there's nothing else that Jesus cares about in our lives? No, there are other things that Jesus cares about in our lives. We've got the whole Sermon on the Mount. Jesus isn't erasing that. In fact, if you keep reading beyond the verses that we read today into verse 18, you would see that Jesus also cares how we relate to the world around us. Nonetheless, the spearhead, if you will, at the front of all of Jesus' vision for your life, it all begins with this: living a fruitful life, living life well in God's vineyard, it looks like this: loving one another as Jesus loved you. Now, how would we know what Jesus really means there? He's given us this direction in verses 12 and 17. Love one another. Well, Jesus, what are you really asking us to do? Well, he tells us in verses 13 through 16. He reminds us how he loved us in ways that should inform how we love one another. So in verse 13, Jesus reminds us how he loved us sacrificially. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. There's a sacrificial love of Jesus for us. If you're a Christian, you know how big a deal this is, and you know how true it is when Jesus says, no one has greater love than this. Because we have seen how he laid down his life for us and for our sins, to make a way for us to be reconciled with him and with the Father forevermore. We've seen the beauty of that sacrificial and reconciling love of Jesus Christ for us. And now, what do we do with it? Jesus says, look around the room. There are people here that I'm calling you to love sacrificially. And then in verses 14 and 15, there's this picture of Jesus loving us with a friendship kind of love that draws us into the Father's vision for everything. Verse 14, you are my friends. Jesus says, you are my friend. Again, I don't want to skip that too quickly because I think some of us need to hear it. Jesus doesn't just say to you, I was willing to lay down my life for you, but I have a hard time tolerating you. Jesus says, I love you and I lay down my life for you, dear disciple, and you are my friends. You're my friends if you do what I command. No longer do I call you only servants. The servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. I've drawn you into this. Why? Because all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. There's this sacrificial kind of love. There's this friendship kind of love that we've experienced from Jesus that we're to extend to one another as we invite them into our lives and as we point each other to the Father's plans for us and for everything. And then in verse 16, not only this sacrificial love and this friendship kind of love, but also this progress kind of love, if you will. Verse 16, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. Do you hear? Jesus is saying, yes, I gladly laid down my life for you in the past. And yes, I have revealed the Father's will to you, and I've invited you into a status of friendship. But Jesus says to you, if you belong to him, I'm still at work in your life. And I'm still seeking your good and your progress in the faith. I'm still at work in your life, leading you toward greater fruitfulness and leading you closer into the Father's agenda and leading you further into the school of prayer. But as Jesus is saying these things, notice right where he turns in verse 17. These things that I'm talking about, loving each other sacrificially, loving each other with a friendship kind of love, loving each other with an ongoing kind of love that seeks progress in the kingdom, these things I command you so that you will, what? Keep on loving each other with that kind of love with which I've loved you. We live in an era when people often will say things like this. I like Jesus, I just don't really like the church. You know what I mean? And when I talk with someone who says that, usually my first response is, well, I'm glad you like Jesus. I think Jesus is pretty awesome too. And very often, in all honesty, I just identify with a friend who would say something like that and say, I've been disappointed by church also. If you've been hurt by church, I've felt hurt by people in church too. I sympathize with that, and I do not want to make any excuses for how people who should represent the heart of Jesus have done the opposite. But at some point, if we really love Jesus, if we're really interested in the real Jesus as he's revealed in Scripture, we need to notice that Jesus really loves his church. Jesus really loves his church, like with the kind of love that with which the Father loved him. And if we are united with Jesus so that his life is being provided for us day by day, if we're really united with Jesus so that his joy is in us, as verse 11 says, if we're really abiding in the love of Jesus Christ, if we're really abiding in the love of Jesus Christ, then part of the fruit that will be produced in our lives through our union with him will be an increasing love for the people he loves. An increasing love for those for whom he was willing to lay down his life. An increasing depth of friendship. At least a desire for an increasing depth of friendship with those who Jesus has decided to call his friends. An increasing desire to not just make progress me alone individually in my private faith that I never talk to anybody else about, but desire to help others make progress in following Jesus, realizing this is the Jesus that I love. This is what he wants for their lives. See, if we're united with Jesus and if we're abiding in his love for us, then a great part of the fruit that our lives should be producing is not only personal, individual, isolated progress, but love for the people that he loves. Joy in the people that he delights in himself. An alignment of willingness to lay down our lives, to set aside our preferences sometimes, to set aside our privileges and prerogatives sometimes, to kneel down and wipe the snot off kids' noses once in a while out of love for Jesus Christ. Maybe even to wash feet. A willingness not only to remember, a willingness when we remember the wrongs that have been done to us, to remember Jesus paid the price for those wrongs. Therefore, I can forgive without holding it against them. I have like two or three different illustrations colliding in my brain right now. I'm sorry. Well, I'm just going to go with this one, what Matthew shared earlier today. I asked him to send it to me. I said, I want to quote you, bro. But did you hear what Matthew said earlier today? Talking about how husbands can learn about loving wives. I love this testimony that Matthew shared today. Last year at age 50, God poured his love into me so deeply that it has changed everything about me, Matthew said. And what's the result of that? It's not just that Matthew loves to vibe to certain kinds of spiritual music by himself now. What's the result of God pouring his love into Matthew's heart so deeply that it changes everything? Here's what it means for Matthew, at least. He says, I'm empowered now to love others in a way that would have felt impossible for me in the past. He says, I can love Dawn, not out of my very limited resource, but out of the infinite resources of God. Why? Because Matthew, what I'm saying is Matthew's not making that stuff up. If Jesus is right, then the kind of love with which the Father loves the Son is how he loves you. And as we abide in that love, do you know what kind of stuff starts to grow out of our lives? That kind of love for others that he loves as well. I wonder if you're aware of maybe a specific person that feels really difficult to love among Jesus' disciples. Jesus is calling you today to abide in the safety, the provision, the warmth, the care of his love for you. And he's calling you to abound by stepping toward that individual in love, in ways that reflect his sacrificial, friendship, progress-oriented type love for us. I wonder if there are groups of people among the disciples that you have a hard time loving. Jesus gives us a path forward. It doesn't start with try harder. It doesn't start with get more answers to your questions. It doesn't start with look more impressive. In fact, it might start with looking a little less impressive in your eyes or the eyes of others as you humble yourself a little bit. It might start by moving forward in faith even while you still have questions. It might start with moving forward in love even when you feel like you've got no energy left, but you're able to take that step. Why? Because you believe that He really will provide everything you need this week for life and for fruitfulness as you keep on abiding in the safety, security, warmth, and relationship of His love. Maybe there's a step you need to take towards someone in particular here in this church family. Maybe there's a step of love that you know you need to grow in and make some progress in. And sometimes when the Father is doing pruning work, cutting stuff out of our lives, it's painful and it's hard and it's frustrating. But listen, we know it's for our good. If Jesus is at work doing some surgical removing of stuff, if He's doing some pruning in your heart, and you might say, that feels like it's losing something important to me, know this, you can trust the Father. Every cut into our hearts is a pruning that is only designed to produce more good fruit. And if it seems difficult to figure out how you could even begin to care about that other person, know this. Consider how deeply Jesus loved her, or loved him, or loved them. Consider the depths of His love for us. And when you find there just isn't even the energy or the strength to keep going in that, keep on abiding in His love, and you'll keep on discovering the fresh provisions of His work by His Spirit alive in you again today. Renewed and abounding. This week I heard the news that John M. Perkins passed away. A lot of ministers in the Christian world have disappointed me. John Perkins is one of the good ones, I think. 90-some years old, leaves behind a legacy of faithful ministry. I've benefited many times across the years by reading his books and listening to his talks. Here's just one little snippet from Reverend John M. Perkins, who passed away this week. He says, "If you really want to live, find something worth dying for. And know that love is the final fight." It's one thing for John M. Perkins to say that, but doesn't it ring even more clearly when we see how closely aligned that is with the call of Jesus himself? Jesus says, if you really want to live, come and get involved in caring for the people that I died for. And know that love is the final fight, but not a fight that you'll fight alone. It's a fight you'll keep on fighting with me working within you day by day. Lesson number one from this passage, abide in His love. Lesson number two, abound in His love for others. And I think I can summarize the whole message for you in five words. Dear branches, abide to abound. In fact, if five words is too many for you to write, for kids who are taking notes, you could summarize the whole message like this. You could write abide or abiding on one side of your paper, and you could write abounding on the other, and you could draw an arrow from abiding to abounding. Because what Jesus is teaching us in this passage is that as we abide in Him and abide in His love for us, we can, we will abound in love for others more and more for our good, with His joy welling up within us and to the glory of God. At this time,